How's it going? And welcome to episode 135 of On The Wire, proud member of the Pitcherless Podcast Network. Follow the pod on the Twitter at On The Wire Pod. I am Adam Howe. You can follow me at 80 Grid. That's all spelled out. Once again, joined by Kevin Hastings. He should be followed on the Twitter at HastingKevin. And this is our first official off-season pod, Kevin. We are recording this a little earlier than we normally do. Full disclosure, we record this on Thursday. We're going to publish it out on Sunday, probably. And so we got a lot of time in between. So a lot could happen. But that's the beauty of off-season, is that we have this little bit of a luxury in our timing so we can get these all these pods recorded. The non-luxury we have is the ability to watch baseball today, which was basically canceled due to four sweeps of the wild card round. Not necessarily what I expected. How about you?
No, I would think there would be at least one of the four series that would go to a third game. But so we're sitting here on first week of the playoffs, and we're going to have two consecutive days of no baseball. So we're here waiting till Saturday until we get to watch games. But I do these division round matchups. I think we're going to get at least a couple of really exciting series.
Yeah, I agree. I think Alex Fast put out a tweet today. It's just, which one are you looking forward to the most? And I threw, I think if you go back and look at the Pitcherlist staff prediction article, it's over at Pitcherlist. If I'm not mistaken, we picked the Twins to win the whole thing. And so I'm looking forward to that series just to see that one work out. And as exciting as the Twins actually looked this past 2 days as they beat up on the Blue Jays, I'll be interested to see how that series works out. How about you?
Definitely. And I'm also excited to see, until they slumped for a while in August and into early September, the Rangers were really looking good again throughout most of September, did end up not winning the division. The Astros took that. So I think Rangers and Orioles is also, I'm really looking forward to these American League series and the National League as well. But both American League series really piqued my interest quite a bit. I think it could be really competitive and possibly go. I don't think we'll see sweeps in either of those. That's for sure.
Yeah. On the National side, I think what worked out nicely for at least one team, Arizona, is the fact that they did sweep. So they have this extra time off. They can reset their rotation and get Merrill Kelly and Zach Gallen to go games 1 and 2 against the Dodgers. So I think that's pretty big for them. Personally, they surprised me by beating up on Milwaukee. I thought Milwaukee was going to be a playoff darling, if you will. I thought they could go deep into the playoffs. Obviously, we'll get to one of those pieces of news that probably hindered them a little bit in a little bit. But yeah, I think that Arizona team is going to be a fun team to watch moving forward. And if they can pull up the upset on the Dodgers, that'll be a team to watch in the National League.
Yeah, the Dodgers don't have the pitching we're used to. So last evening, we mentioned the postseason hold'em tournament or league that NFBC puts on for the postseason, and it doesn't start until the division round. And a friend of mine that helps me out, we play the league, we'll put in a couple of teams together, and we were on the phone for 3 hours last night, and we didn't make any final decisions. We were just spinning, right, just spinning different scenarios, and we kept coming back to the fact that the Dodgers don't have the pitching we're used to them having in the postseason. Are we going to load up on Arizona players? And it's a possibility. It's something that's crossing our minds.
Yeah, you got to assume that if Corbin Carroll can make it post the divisional series, that those points he can put up and what he's done this season, obviously, is any indication of what he can do in the playoffs. Those are big points that can multiply into further rounds.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those that don't know, you have to have, the rosters are 16 players per round. And so with there being 8 teams in the division round, the minimum is 1 player from each team and the maximum 3 players from each team. So you'll average out having 2 players per team, obviously, but there is some strategy to towards players from the teams that you think will advance. So you get those multipliers going forward. You get any player you had in the first round that you keep in the second round. And I can't think, other than injury, there's no reason you would wouldn't keep everybody you had in the first round if they advance. You get two times the amount of points that they would typically score in that second round. And then on to the World Series, if it's a player you used in the championship series, you get two times. But if you had them since the division series, then you get three times their points they accumulate during the World Series. So picking the correct players in the division round is key.
Yeah, this starts up on Saturday, so it doesn't really matter what we talk about here because we're not going to publish this until
Exactly. We can talk about any of the players we want to talk about.
Those drafts are already done by the time you're listening to this, so I apologize if you're like, oh, great, I can go join this draft based on what they're talking about. Nope, sorry. Just follow along for the fun of it because this is all supposed to be fun anyway.
Exactly.
All right. I guess I alluded to earlier, we did have some news come through. There's at least one news item here that's like probably about 2 weeks old, but I'm going to throw it in here anyway, just because we haven't talked about it. It really didn't impact our FAB, but it does impact early drafts. So let's get into the unfortunate news that kept Brandon Woodruff off of the wild card roster for the Brewers. He was diagnosed with another right shoulder injury, kept him off the wild card. It was contemplated that he would miss more than just the wild card round if the Brewers had advanced. Obviously, they did not. So it's that question that's never going to be answered. He's going to get some second opinions and see how that turns out for him throughout the offseason and how he deals with it. But there's a lot of people speculating that this is going to carry through the offseason, and if he requires any kind of surgery, it's going to impact how he can perform or if he can perform the start of 2024, Kevin. So with that unknown that we see here, like, there's other players that we have to take into consideration with this, right? With the unknown injury, Max Scherzer comes to mind, obviously, with his injury he dealt with at the very end of the season. Not expected to play in these playoffs for the Rangers as well. And anybody else that got put on the IL at the very end of the season, not something we have to deal with. We'll get to one where we obviously have to deal with or don't have to deal with for sure in a little bit. But with Woodruff specifically, and then if you want to tie in Scherzer or anybody else, how far do these guys have to drop in a draft that you know, let's just say might be doing starting this weekend? Hopefully, if we can fill this first listener league by the time you're listening to this, hopefully it's already full and started. But like, how does somebody like Woodruff or Woodruff himself actually have to drop for you to feel comfortable taking that risk for what is an obvious reward?
Yeah, I don't think there is a point where I will be comfortable. He missed 4 months this season from a similar, if not the same injury.
At least the same shoulder. Yeah.
Right. And the same type of injury, I believe. So I don't know if he re-injured it, aggravated it, if it was healed and just fluky re-injured the same part of his shoulder again. But it sounds like it's the same thing. And so there's no point where I will be comfortable. But there probably is a spot where I might be able to convince myself it's worth the risk. Unfortunately, in many of these situations in the past, I've convinced myself that too early is the spot to become comfortable. As we talked with Derek last week, I still keep drafting Jacob deGrom every season. But I'm thinking, and I don't even know if he'll make it this far. Of course, it's going to depend on any other news that we get soon. But I'm thinking at least double-digit rounds. And I don't know how far he drops. If there's drops like the one we have coming up, I don't know where somebody is going to grab him. We haven't seen a timeline at all. Just won't be available for the playoffs. If he missed 4 months of it earlier this season, okay, that he could be ready for spring training if it's the same recovery time or less. But there is just, with Woodruff right now, way too much unknown. It's not even really a risk I'm willing to take at almost any. It would have to get to that point in a draft where we're throwing darts, right? And so I don't see that happening. Now, this is a FAB league that we're drafting.
Right.
Hopefully it has begun by the time listeners are hearing this on Sunday, and so that makes it a little earlier for me. I'd actually take him earlier in the FAB league than in a draft champions, draft and hold league right now. I think that's probably pretty obvious, but it's still, I'm going to really want to have a really good foundation for my team before I start taking that risk. Late teens, before I'd even think about it. And I don't know if he's going to fall that far.
This feels really, and I know it's obviously apples to oranges, the hitter and a pitcher and all that, and his shoulder on a pitcher obviously plays a little bit more of a role, but this feels really similar to the kind of the non-news or news we got revolving around Max Muncy last offseason. And then all of a sudden we got something that was just like, oh yeah, he's never been healed. And it has not been. And then all of a sudden he drops to pick 200. 250 in some drafts. And obviously that was a steal at the time. In retrospect, hindsight being what it is, he still put up a 200 average or so, but he still gave you what you needed, especially out of pick 200 or 250. And it worked out in that way. And I think this is the argument, or this is part of the argument why people, I wouldn't necessarily say this, I do enjoy drafting early. But I would say that a lot of people would say draft early because you can find you can take these risks, you can throw these darts and they can work out. Obviously, there are plenty of darts that miss the board completely and you don't know it until April comes around. But these are those darts that I think early drafters are talking about, where it's like, yeah, the unknown is where you can make up the ground on these picks. So you can take that risk on Woodruff or Scherzer or whatever in the teens, like you mentioned, and he can turn out to be fine. Like he can turn out, like we get news in 2 to 3 months and that he is perfectly fine. As unlikely as that might sound at this moment, it is still in the realm of possibility. And you can profit from that draft selection. I don't think it's a safe way of thinking, for sure. But if you're drafting in October, safety isn't necessarily what isn't at the top of your mind all the time. But maybe it should be. So yeah, the Muncy thing is what came to mind when I saw this, as far as what I think we'll experience in the first couple months of the season as we get no news. Like I just don't think we're going to get much, if any, news on Woodruff's availability now that the Brewers are out of the playoffs.
And I pulled up his game log, and so the 9 starts that he made when he came back during 2023, 2.59 ERA, 3.70 WHIP, or excuse me, FIP, and 62 strikeouts in 55 innings, averaged over 6 innings per start. That was so valuable. And so I'm already contradicting what I just got done talking about and thinking, now maybe this is something I want to, because coming back from the same injury, he performed well when he did come back. He was Brandon Woodruff, the Woodruff we see out there with the over strikeout per inning and the great. It's something we're going to have to monitor. I don't see myself drafting him in this first couple of early drafts. But once again, I don't know how far people are going to let him fall. He even went 9 innings on September 11th versus Miami.
And that's where this came from, supposedly.
Yeah, but he went 6 innings the following start. Goodness. And then finished up with 5. A dud, 5 innings, 4 earned runs at Miami. He faced Miami 2 of his last 3 starts. So, yeah, it is so tough. And I, like you said, I doubt we hear much news on this for quite some time. Probably December winter meetings is probably the earliest we can hope to start hearing anything. And so that's going to make it really tough for early drafters.
All right, let's talk about somebody who came back from injury at the very last possible second. The Yankees activated Frankie Montas at the very end of the year. He did make 1 appearance on September 30th, right before the end of the season, went 1.1 innings, did get the win. So cool. He recorded the win in his only appearance in 2023. He walked 1, struck out 1, whatever, all that. Did allow 2 hits in those 4 outs. But it was nice. It was a nice gesture. They didn't have to bring him back, but it was nice to have him come out there and earn the paycheck and all that. Do you see this as anything more than just a nice touch, though? Or are you looking at this as a positive thing that he was able to finally make his way back and get on the mound at the major league level before the end of the season? And is that going to impact the way you rank or look at him in any draft? And it doesn't have to be the early drafts. We're not, again, this is somebody else we're not going to get a lot of news on, I don't think, throughout the offseason, because it's this, the news cycle has ended for him now.
Yeah, but for what we do know, as of right now, he's healthy. Paul Sporer was the first I heard talk about this several years ago, and I've heard many others echo it in recent years. That one and a third innings does give me confidence. I love to see it, especially somebody that has been out the entire season. Mm-hmm. It does make me take interest. And then guys like this, the question becomes, how many innings do we expect him to be able to go in 2024, even if he is perfectly healthy all season long? He was down to 144 innings in 2022. That was actually the second most of his career after 187 in 2021. What are we expecting if he's healthy all season? 120 at best case scenario is probably what I'm looking at.
Is that a 120? Is that a 120 throughout 30 or so starts? Or is that 120 in less starts because he hits the IL a couple more times?
That's the problem. I think he gets limited in both ways, right? I think they ease him in early in the season, and we would expect that, I believe. But once he is rolling and still healthy, and we're into May and June, they may still not let him go over five innings. So then it becomes a bigger issue in the innings per start. So that will be my concern, but I do have more confidence in him being healthy and ready to go, just because we did see that, even if it was only for four outs, it gives me more confidence going into 2024.
Yeah, that's probably fair. Yeah. I like the call out to Sporer, like, you're healthy now. That's what's the measurement of health, is your health at this very moment. You can't necessarily worry about what's going to happen. Yes, previous injury is indicative of future injury, or it's a best predictor of future injury. I get that. But at the same time, you're healthy now. You can throw a ball and at the velocity we expect, then you have to go with that. All right. The one I alluded to earlier, Felix Bautista, he made it official. He's going to get Tommy John surgery. Obviously, he'll miss the entirety of 2024. With the typical Tommy John surgery timeline, though, I would expect him to be ready for spring training in 2025. We don't have to worry about that for another 50 or so episodes, though. So let's just talk about what
we expect. I don't know. It gets earlier every year.
Yeah, that's true. So Baltimore is still going to need a closer, and we're going to get we've gotten a preview, obviously, of how they are handling their end of game situation over the course of the last month. And then we're going to see what happens throughout the playoffs, but how we're doing a draft, like we're doing drafts now, we don't get the luxury of seeing how they're going to handle it in the playoffs or what happens. How confident are you that the 2024 closer for the Baltimore Orioles is already on that roster for you to draft? Or would you expect them to go out and get a one-year rental of somebody with the experience to hold down the fort while Bautista gets healthy?
Yeah, this is a tough one, because even teams with good closers and good candidates in their bullpen, with the foundation that the Orioles have now, we expect them to be contenders for quite some time. I think most of us do. But we also expect the Yankees and Red Sox to be back at some point as well. So they can't just say, okay, we're fine. I think they would be perfectly fine with Yennier Cano going into 2024 as their closer. At the same time, they're going to add bullpen depth over the offseason. Good teams add to their bullpen depth in the offseason typically. And if it happens to be a guy with some ninth inning experience, they were still using Cano as a setup guy after Bautista was out at times. He was not the guy. He got saves, but he wasn't the guy. So it's tough. I think I draft him the same way I was drafting Evan Phillips last season, which worked out But even if it didn't, in the spot where I was drafting him, he would have remained on my roster all season long anyway. That we talk about those guys all the time on our show, almost on a weekly basis throughout. Now, Cano may cost more than Phillips did last season. And in fact, he probably will. But as long as that doesn't get too inflated, I would draft him probably expecting 15 to 20 saves, hoping that he's the guy and gets me that 30 plus. But I, because of this, I think he probably does come at a little bit of a discount. Probably not at, we won't get him as late as we got Phillips last season.
Yeah, I think I'm in the camp that I guess it really depends on what Baltimore does in the playoffs this year, but I expect them to be active in the free agent market this offseason, way more so than we expected them to, that they didn't actually fall through with last season. But they are obviously at a point where the best, they have the best record in the American League. They number one seed, expected to do some damage in the playoffs, if not go deep into it. And so they have this core that they can very easily build around with the free agent crop that we see this year, this offseason. And there are some interesting relievers slash closers or relievers with closing experience that will be on the market and wouldn't necessarily be looking for a 3 or 4 year deal. Like, we have the Craig Kimbrels of the world that, as much as we've seen him struggle at times, really fits exactly what I think Baltimore could need as a 1 year stopgap, and maybe even like a one with a some kind of option going into 2025. You have Josh Hader obviously on the market, but that's not a fit for Baltimore in their situation. In my mind, he's fit for anybody, don't get me wrong, but if you're looking for that 1 year guy, Trevor May, Craig Kimbrel, even David Robertson, these guys have the experience at the end, some with less success than others. But I would expect, I'm expecting Baltimore to make that move. So I'm less confident to take a risk in these early drafts and grabbing somebody like Cano, who, yes, I agree, if he's the guy, it's going to be like any of these situations where you weren't sure who was going to be the guy, and then all of a sudden they'll realize, oh, there's nobody else on the free agent market, or, oh, that's right, David Bednar's not actually going to get traded, and then they shoot up the boards. That probably is something I'm not willing to take the risk on in these early drafts, but I would have most of the confidence in Cano to be the guy if it came a little bit more clear that he didn't really have the competition of a seasoned veteran that would come in from the outside.
Yeah, absolutely. He'll be 30 years old next season.
Cano?
Yeah.
That is not something I had in front of me.
That's why I brought it up. Yeah. I just looked at that. I'm like, he'll be 30 years old.
You have the right Cano, before the, right? No.
I do. Before the beginning of the season, he will be 30 years old.
All right. Happy birthday. All right. One more piece of news, and we're going to get to that after we take this quick break. All right. Kevin, it's not really news. It's just like this happens every year. There's always managerial openings across baseball, and the ones that I come across so far, please fill in any gaps that I might have left. But there's going to be, we already know of a few. I would expect there to be at least one or two more announced before the end of the playoffs as well. But for right now, we know that Buck Showalter will not be coming back to the Mets. Gabe Kapler, it was fired from the Giants before the end of the season. Terry Francona had already announced he was going to be stepping down in Cleveland. Phil Nevin is out in Anaheim. Dusty Baker's not committed to Houston past this postseason. Craig Counsell's kind of in the same boat where they're already out, so technically he's not the manager of Milwaukee anymore. He's not signed past 2023 either. With all these openings, and on top of that, this recent criticism that we saw flying around with the Blue Jays, how they handled the Jose Berrios on game two of their wildcard series, and how that probably wasn't a decision that manager John Schneider made, or at least Whit Merrifield was very clear in, I think he was very clear in what he thought, how he thought that went down. And it wasn't Schneider making the decision there. With that being said, like, how much impact do you really think managers are going to have in any of these openings or any other openings? And are there any situations across baseball where you feel a manager can actually, you know, play his hand in how the game is played by that team?
Yeah, this is, it's unfortunate all managers are these days are scapegoats, right? And it works, right? You brought it up with John Schneider on Wednesday after Jose Barrios was removed in the fourth inning because there was two lefties coming up. We presume that's why he was lifted after walking one batter, and he seemed to be cruising along pretty well, 47 pitches, right? John Schneider did not make that decision. There is no way he made that decision. But he's getting all the criticism from the fans, right? And that's the only thing the managers are really there for anymore, right? The front offices are making these decisions. And the manager is there for as a PR to go into that post conference after the game and explain why he made the decision that he's not really even the one that made it. So it's unfortunate. I think there are some guys around, and some of it's the old school guys, some of it's some of the newer managers in the league that I think kind of help. It's more the philosophical leaders, the guys that really cater to what he thinks their players need to hear, and that communication and kind of being a buffer between this new way of the front offices. And it's been happening for several years and longer with different teams, but cushioning the blow on decisions that aren't going to be popular and holding the teams together. As a Royals fan, Ned Yost was not liked by most Royals fans, even heading into the 2014 wildcard game at that time. Still, every loss was, we got Yosted. Everything was Ned Yost's fault. And I loved Ned Yost. And I maintain to this day, the Royals do not go to either one of the World Series that they went to in 2014 and 2015 and winning in 2015 without Ned Yost. Those players loved him and they came together for him. And I think there's still some managers like that. Dusty Baker comes to mind that you just brought up in Houston. I think he's one of those types of managers that gets his players to rally around him. We'll criticize him at the same time for not playing Chaz McCormick more often when he's rostered on our fantasy teams. But I think he's a good manager in that regard. And I think that's a good PR guy. Somebody like Dusty Baker handles his players and then is good at getting in front of the microphone and taking the blame, even though the front office did it. Those are the best. That's what teams are looking for now. I don't think they have much of an effect on the outcomes of the games any longer.
We saw somewhat recently Aaron Judge come out in favor of his manager, Aaron Boone. I'm assuming it's not just because they have the same first name, but it's actually he had kind things to say about the way he manages and the way he supports that, and the way he supports his players. It reminds me of what you just said with Ned Yost and how the players rallied around him. And he's on the other end, Aaron Boone, especially in the last couple weeks of the season, wasn't exactly the best behind the mic as far as explaining the decision making process.
What in the world does Phil Nevin have to do with Anaheim not winning? Right? But we're firing him. That's supposed to keep the fans happy. We're trying to get somebody new in here, and he's not the problem.
So that is a really long-winded way, I think, of both of us saying no. I'm like,
exactly.
I feel like I bring this up every offseason. I'm like, oh, what kind of impact are we going to? And I always bring back when Matheny came into Kansas City, we're like, oh, this is an old school guy. He doesn't like to run, but it's been provided with a team that runs and knows how to run. He's going to run, and they ran. And so it is the manager doesn't play as much of a role as people probably would like them to like to think that they do as far as game management. To your point, yeah, they are still the player's persona. They are still like the face of the franchise in that way. And that can blessing and a curse at the same time.
Absolutely.
All right. I think that's a good amount of news to go over this week, Kevin. And the thing that we're missing that we talked about at the beginning of the show is that we're missing playoff baseball because they got swept across the board in the wild card round. And now we have the divisional round coming up this weekend to start. And obviously the league championships and World Series after that by the end of the month. With that, so there is still baseball being played. And there are drafts happening now, and there will be drafts happening throughout the offseason. And we see this every year, or at least we hear about this every year, right? That there are certain players that can do more or less for themselves in the way that, in which they are able to make a name for themselves in the postseason. We'll get to a couple of guys that I noticed grabbed some ADP from last year while I still could from NFBC and compared some players who did really well and at least one player who didn't do that well and how that might have impacted their ADP in early drafts compared to, say, November drafts or just past the postseason. So what I want to talk to you about is who were the players that you're either looking at or expecting to either have already made a bigger name for themselves based on what they did in the wildcard round or what they could continue to build on moving forward in throughout the playoffs. And thus is how much of an impact is that going to play in your evaluation on them moving forward? And I think the biggest poster boy for this is not a common situation, but like when Randy Arozarena came in and he literally came in, I think it was during the playoffs or it was like the day before the playoffs or whatever. And he did obviously really well in that time, wins rookie of the year the following year, but he lit the world on fire from the get-go in the playoffs on the biggest stage. And so he became a household name in a way really quickly in this short period of time. We talk about short samples and how they need to be put into context and all that. The playoffs, they are a different environment. They are a different situation. So first and foremost, Kevin, how much are you allowing playoff performance to influence your evaluation of any player, whether they're a pitcher, a hitter, any position?
I think I really try, the sample size is extremely small, so I really try not to let it to affect me at all. Of course, that's almost impossible. But I do try to minimize it. And the times that it is something that I will intentionally allow it to influence some of my decisions is if a guy came back late in the season from injury and or somebody that we saw improvements from due to something that we can see, a concrete change that they made during the season and began to improve, and does that continue throughout the postseason? But in most cases, it's fun to watch. It makes us remember some of these guys a lot longer after they retire than others. Just one good, no, or a couple good postseasons. I mentioned to you off air that I had a 3-hour phone conversation with a friend last night trying to get our postseason lineups ready to go. And we kept referring to, we need to find our Mark Lemke, right? Who's our Mark Lemke? Because he wasn't the greatest superstar, definitely wasn't a superstar, but in the postseason a couple of times he was a superstar. Yeah, sure. Right. And so when a guy like that does come around, it's hard not to let it influence our decisions the following year. Oh, if he could do it in that situation, he can definitely do it in the middle of April. It's hard, but unless it was a tangible change and we're looking for continued improvement, or like I said, somebody that came back late in the year due to injury, we shouldn't really pay any attention to it at all.
I think that the thing that I look at the most in playoff is usage, and it is especially in the bullpen. So if a team is willing to forego their closer in a closing situation for their second in command or even their third based on the situation, and they haven't really done that all season, like they went with their guy. Washington did this when they won the World Series. All of a sudden, Daniel Hudson was their closer, and he wasn't their closer all season, but he was the closer during the World Series. That made everybody stand up and watch. I'm like, oh, okay. They trust him in the biggest of situations. This is probably going to be something that they look at in the offseason or make a change the following season. In the usage of starting pitching obviously is going to be a little bit different, though it is always interesting to see which starter doesn't make the rotation in a short series, as we saw with this wild card round. Is obviously
or what pitcher gets lifted in the fourth inning after giving up one walk.
Yeah, exactly. But like you always go into, hey, if you can go into the playoffs with a with a solid 1-2-3. This is why I like the Brewers going in before Woodruff injury was announced. But you have that 1-2-3 punch of Burns, Woodruff, and Peralta. It doesn't matter who 4, 5, or 6 would be. They're not in the rotation in the playoffs, ultimately, unless you have a 4-game stretch where you have to throw somebody else out. But for the most part, these three guys, they are your, they're going to be your horses through the playoffs, and 4, 5, and 6 are going to end up being bullpen arms. And that may influence how they're ranked or utilized going into next year. If I realize, hey, this guy was the number 4, number 5 on this, and then a free agent, they go into a situation where they can be the 1 or 2, it's going to impact what kind of usage I think they're going to get. At the same time, if any other free agent goes in and becomes the 4, 5, or 6 in a situation where they weren't really utilized in that role in the playoffs, I think that I take notice of that as well. I think the bullpen, though, is the one that I look at the most in those situations, because the sample size, regardless of it being on the biggest stage, sample size for hitters is, and we'll get to even the best performers in just a second from last year, is so small. It can be upwards of like 10 games, 13 games, and it can be as low as 2 or 3. But you know what? Last year, I keep alluding to it, last year we did see some guys improve their draft rankings, or at least their ADP based. My question will be, is this based solely on what they did in the playoffs, or are there mitigating factors that I'm just leaving out if I'm cherry picking here? But I'll get you two hitters here, Kevin. You tell me if you can dial back your memory enough where you can remember what other impacts they might have had in their ADP to make this jump. But the most obvious one was Jeremy Peña, who played 13 games in the playoffs. He went 20 for 58 with a slash of .345, .367, .638, 4 home runs in that time, 13 runs scored and 8 RBIs. If I'm just sticking to those counting stats that we care about for fantasy, in a short sample size, that's really all you can look at. You can't really look at all of the ratios in a 58 at bat plus sample. But if you look at his ADP from the first 2 weeks of October, there were only 7 drafts in that time. And I didn't filter. I'm just going to take all 7 drafts here. He had an ADP of 131, min of 87, max of 156. But after November 1st, through all drafts in November, or at least November 1st to the 30th, there were 30 drafts. It went from 131 ADP to a 106. So we're talking about a 2-round difference in a 15, 2.5 to 3-round difference in a 12. Min 61, max of 143. So his max went down, his min went down, his ADP obviously went way down. Harrison Bader, he only played 9 games. He batted .333, .429, .833 with 5 home runs, 8 runs, 6 RBIs. His ADP was just shy of 200 in those earliest of drafts. It dropped to 172 in November drafts. Again, min and max dropped considerably as well, but this, we're talking in the 130 to 213 range on during the month of November. So these two hitters, they did well in the playoffs, they put up some numbers, Peña won some awards. Do you think that what they did in the playoffs influenced that ADP bump, or were there other things that might have been thought about with these two guys?
Absolutely. With Peña, when you're the MVP of 2 of the 3 postseason series at the eventual World Series champions place, that's going to affect things, and that's what we got from Peña. And other than the power being less than what we saw last season and in those postseason games, Peña was fine this year. I think where he was drafted, even after the so-called playoff tax went into effect, I think we definitely wish we would have seen more than 10 home runs, but got up over the 80 runs. Here's the thing about Peña. If you go back and look at his game log, he's hitting 8th or 9th a good portion of the season with several long streaks of hitting 2nd. Now, I didn't dive into this. I think it's okay to make an assumption in this case. Those streaks of hitting 2nd in the lineup is when Altuve was out, I'm guessing. And I'm pretty confident in that without diving in and verifying. That's going to be a big deal, because his RBI were really down on the season on a per game basis, that over what we saw last season. It's hitting at the bottom of the order. So the runs were still there. The average actually went up this season. We didn't see a whole lot of power from him like we saw his rookie year. And that plays a lot into it as well, right? He continued to be awesome after he had been great as a rookie. He continued to be awesome in the postseason for the World Series champion. So he absolutely, that was a playoff tax in Jeremy Peña's case. And I don't think it hurt us too much, but it wasn't what we expected this season.
Yeah, to clarify, you're pretty much absolutely right. He still jumped around in the six hole when Altuve was out, but he was, all the times he was batting second, it did coincide with when Altuve was out, both at the beginning of the season and in July, where obviously he moved up to the two spot and Dubon moved up to the leadoff spot. Leadoff, actually, yeah. Jose Abreu was in leadoff for a couple of games in there as well, which is interesting. Before he remembered, he was a very good baseball player. Yeah, so it's just interesting to see the difference in production, not only based on where they are in the lineup, but like how the roster construction is around them as well, based on injuries and what have you. I mean, I see Peña as a little bit of a cautionary tale. It's like, I was really in on Peña going into 2020.
Absolutely. And I wasn't, I wish I'd had been in on him like you were coming in.
But that's a whole different podcast topic where we talk about these prospects who find their way into an opening that you might not have seen prior without, after free agency works its way through and you realize, oh, hey, they don't have a shortstop. They probably are going to play this guy who is their shortstop of the future anyway. So there's where Jeremy Peña comes in.
Bader, on the other hand, Bader, I think the postseason influenced this, but we've never seen him get much more or many more than 400 plate appearances in a season. And I think his postseason gave people wishful thinking. Like, okay. He's healthy. He performed at the highest level of Major League Baseball. And in the postseason, he was awesome. Five home runs. They have to play him every day when he's healthy. And so the postseason had to do with it, but I don't think it was as warranted as it was with Peña.
Yeah. This is a situation where it's, you have to remember who these guys actually are. And they are who we thought they were, right? It's like that whole montage. And Bader still is who we thought he was. Like somebody who's, when he's on the field and is healthy, can be very good. The power is a little surprising. The five home runs in this short period and only 30 at bats. Bader was brought on to the Yankees, traded with Jordan Montgomery for the outfield defense. He could play center field. And the speed factor, the power was a bonus in my mind. It's there, but it's not like the carrying tool. And so to see that, it's like I see that and I have to take that with a grain of salt.
It matched his regular season total.
Yeah, exactly. Yet,
and now he had 16 in 2021. So that plays into it as well, right? Oh, he's got it. It's coming back.
There it is.
Coming back. He can be a 2020 guy. No matter how the numbers move, no matter how many home runs become as impressive as they once were, and no matter how many more stolen bases it's going to take for our fantasy leagues, 2020 potential is always going to be appealing.
It's going to be a topic. Yes. It's just good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he can be a 2020 if he can get the 600 at-bats. That's the key part. We talk about this with projections. It's like projections are great to use, but you need to adjust based on what you think the total plate appearances or total innings are going to actually be, because that's all what those projections are based on. All right, I got a couple pitchers here that we need to get to, and we're going to get to those and also some players that we're looking at for 2023 playoffs right after this break. All right, Kevin, I got two pitchers from last postseason that adjusted their ADP based on their performance. One good, one not so good. We'll start with the positive here. Christian Javier, he pitched in three games. Two of them he started. Did go two, so he got two wins out of that short sample size. 12 and two-third innings. He only let up one earned run. Five walks, though. 16 strikeouts in those 12 and two-thirds. That equates to a 0.71 ERA. He had a very early draft ADP of 95-ish, min of 77, max of 134. His November drafts, though, he dropped down a whole round to 83 and with a minimum pick of 61, max of 116. So big drop in his picks became more condensed as well. So like the difference between his min and max was much less. His max went down a good 30 spots as well. So nobody was taking too many chances on missing out on Christian Javier as they were in the very earliest of drafts. Christian Javier was a darling of communication throughout the offseason. Everybody's talking about him anyway. He didn't do himself any harm with this playoff performance, at least on a total scale. Obviously, also pitching for the Astros didn't hurt as well. The biggest of biggest stages, always in the spotlight. Do you put any influence on what he did in the playoffs into how that impacted his ADP? Or do you just think this is a situation where everybody's just talking him up because they saw what he could possibly do, the role he was going to get moving into 2023? We're not going to talk about what he actually did in 2023. I mean, you can, but that's not what influenced this draft cost. What are your thoughts on Javier and what he did?
Yeah, the postseason absolutely had some influence. Now, he was, like you said, he was already moving up draft boards from the previous season, obviously. He'd only had 9 starts in 2021, had 25 in 2022, and they were very good. So he was already on people's radars, but then his postseason performance just gave it that little bit of extra boost. I remember watching World Series games in Arizona, and there's all hundreds of fantasy baseball fans here watching him perform.
Your worst and, places to watch the World Series.
Yeah, absolutely. But he was the talk of the postseason as far as pitchers go. I think everybody was enamored with what he had been doing throughout the season and then keeping it up in the postseason. So it absolutely contributed. And on the flip side, yeah, I think Aaron Nola dropped in drafts due to what had transpired in the postseason. He was a disappointment for the Phillies. And it's a completely, I want to say it's a completely different situation. It's really not, though. It was just opposite outcomes. The Javier performing at the highest level in the postseason did bump him up above and beyond the bump he was already getting from his awesome regular season. Aaron Nola still dropped, and he wasn't absolutely horrendous, but he didn't do what Phillies fans and those that were watching the Phillies play in the postseason expected of him.
Yeah, Aaron Nola, he started 5 games throughout the postseason, went 2-2, 25 and 2/3 innings, 14 earned runs, 5 walks. Only 5 walks, that feels pretty good, especially after the control issues we've seen out of him this year. 27 strikeouts, which is nice, but obviously those 14 earned runs translates into a just shy of 5 ERA, a 4.91 ERA. In those earliest of drafts, he was still going ADP of 37. He had a 32 to 42 min max, but then after the playoffs ended, he dropped down in November drafts to 52, ADP of 52, min of 29, went as high as 82. Overall in the November drafts. You can chalk it up to, hey, you know what? Everybody remembered this was going to be an odd year, and so Aaron Nola wasn't going to be good in an odd year. Everybody knows that's science. But the influence that this was recency bias, right? This is the last thing everybody remembers about Aaron Nola was that he choked, but he just did not perform the way you want him to perform at the highest stage. So it had to play a part. Maybe, obviously, Aaron Nola was a back-and-forth player throughout course of 2023. You didn't know if you actually wanted to keep rostering him. You didn't know if you could trust him putting him out from start to start. A little bit of a cherry bomb throughout the season. So maybe this kind of did some people some favors. But the Christian Javier, in a similar situation, you didn't want Christian Javier on your team for a good chunk of 2023. But yet, you paid the freight. Based on his performance, not only from 2022, but the playoffs, So these are the cautionary tales that I'm trying to bring up and be like, realize, you know what, there's more to it than just this small sample size. You got to keep that in mind. And I don't know, in my mind, you can't let, and you led with it, you can't really allow it to influence yourself too much unless you see an actual change in how they're performing as far as how they're swinging the bat or how they're, if their velocity is up or down consistently. As Nick Pollock always says, like if they are sitting at a certain velocity rather than just hitting, obviously that's more important in like spring training and as you're leading up to the season, but it is an important term to keep in mind when you are listening to where these guys are what they're doing on the mound.
Yeah, and I know I'm getting ahead of ourselves here a little bit on the rundown, but I'm afraid Aaron Nola already ruined our discount for next season. Run out there and threw seven innings. And
what are you doing, Nola? Week.
Yeah, what are you doing? Because when you talk about the every other year and then just look at the home runs per nine every other year, and we know that number it's is volatile, uncanny. Right? We know that number is so volatile, but that is the number that explains everything with Aaron Nola, because his underlying numbers this season were exactly the same as they were last season, everything except the home run percentages. And so if that drops back down next season, I think we're looking at a nice little discount on Aaron Nola, and he's out there messing it up for everybody.
Well, new wrinkle,
by pitching well in the postseason.
There's a new wrinkle for Aaron Nola. Is that he might not be in Philly next year. That odd even thing might not matter if he's pitching in, that, say, you know,
depending
Baltimore.
Depending on where he yeah. ends up, that could really help that home run rate as well.
No, yeah. You think he'd want to be picky about that. That's a very interesting piece to consider, is how does ballpark situations actually how much does that actually influence a player and where they actually want to play?
All are you they do is look at Colorado.
Yeah.
Sign a free agent.
That's
they have
the
to
extreme.
Trade more and more development. Cincinnati's becoming that way. Most teams in Cincinnati's situation, we'd be like, yeah, you go sign a couple free agent pitchers this season and you're off and rolling. They're going to have a very difficult time without overpaying by millions of dollars to get those free agents to come to Great American Small Park.
Yeah, there's so many factors in where especially major free agents go, not only the ballpark, but obviously the team construct and where they're at. But money, not only contract size, but taxes, they have to play a factor. Like if you're deciding whether or not you're going to sign in Toronto versus Miami, there's a big swing in monetary compensation that needs to happen in order to counteract the whole taxes thing and all that. Whole different podcast, I'm sure. So these are guys that kind of influenced, and there are more, but we have so much time here, that influenced their ADP from the 2022 playoffs. Kevin, who can or who has already from what you've seen in the wild card round and then look previewing the divisional round, at least who's going to influence their ADP from, we've already seen a couple boards or at least partial boards of drafts. So we're going to get ADP soon, probably in the next, I don't know, probably in the next week or two, depending on how fast these first couple DCs finish up. So we'll have a little bit of a sample, but then we're going to get a whole new ADP through November. And that's going to be influenced by some of these playoff runs.
Yeah, the first one that comes to mind, and this is obviously he was more touted prospect, but it was going to be really tough for me to try to figure out where I was comfortable with Royce Lewis with the injury concerns. And now his postseason performance, two home runs in game one, it's like, man, he is so good. And he's probably going to be drafted higher than he should be with these injury concerns. And after in hindsight, mistakes I made this past season I thought I learned my lesson with Christian Yelich a few seasons ago, and then I was right back to my old ways this season. And a guy like Royce Lewis, when healthy, I would love to have him, but I think his postseason is going to send his costs soaring in draft season.
Yeah, he's already had the first home run, I think, of the postseason. So of course you get that tweet out there, you get on the center
second
stage
one in
that,
a game, and
yeah. Like, and now obviously the Twins move on to the next round, and
yeah, if he comes out of the postseason healthy, he's going to be out of my price range next season. Unfortunately, probably would have been anyway, but
that's fair. Yeah, I think that there would have been opportunity for some of the younger guys in Tampa Bay to have made names for themselves that aren't going to get the opportunity. Maybe luckily if they were guys that you were on or not. So there's that to also keep in mind, that if you were in on somebody and they are out of it, keep that to yourself. That's fine. Put that in your back pocket. Don't forget about it. And don't let the production of other guys that maybe are coming out of the woodwork that you weren't really in on, who have really positive impacts in the postseason, kind of influence the guys that you were already on.
100%.
Anybody else besides the obvious Royce Lewis, the low-hanging fruit, if you will, just because of what he has already been able to do in the wild card round? Obviously, we've got guys in Baltimore who haven't tasted the postseason in ever. Not only because of their youth, but also just because of the franchise's lack of the actually making it to the postseason in, I forgot what year it was, but it's been a while. And so Baltimore is the new team on the block. Houston hadn't played in a wild card game, so obviously they've been around just about everybody on that roster. I think that Yennier Diaz is somebody that I'll be keeping an eye on. I think that he has the ability to basically do what Jeremy Peña did the year prior for the same team, as long as he's given the opportunity by Dusty Baker and company to actually put forth what he can do. And we all know he's the better hitting catcher on that roster. And if they want to score runs and put the ball in play more often, Diaz needs to be in the game much more so than Maldonado. And if they do that and he takes advantage of that, the question obviously is going to be all off season about whether or not he is taking over full range going into 2024. How much playing time will he actually get? Is Dusty Baker still the manager? A lot of questions still revolve around how that situation pans out. But he's going to be a top catching target. Maybe he doesn't move up a whole bunch in ADP, but he'll be more targeted, I think, with a very strong postseason run.
I agree. I mentioned my 3-hour phone call last evening, and the buddy I was talking to is in Texas. I said, hey, will you get a hold of Dusty Baker and ask him how many lineups he's going to be in over the next few days? That's very valuable information right now. Right? And so absolutely, if he does get the opportunity and does capitalize, I think the narrative becomes they can't keep him out of the lineup. The Houston Astros are usually good enough that, yeah, they could. If they want Jordan Alvarez in the DH spot and they want the defense and framing of Martin Maldonado behind the plate, they absolutely will. They're good enough. They can win without Diaz. They might want his extra boost in the postseason. And yeah, and more so than he can't flop, but more so than performance, I think being in the lineup every day during the postseason will send his draft cost up quite a bit. We'd think that, oh, they trust him in the postseason, just like we were talking with pitchers earlier. If they trust him in the postseason, then they're going to get him in the lineup more next regular season. And that may be the case, but I'd be a little leery of it. Like I said, the Astros can win a lot of regular season games without him.
Yeah, absolutely. One more name I'll be watching throughout the rest of the postseason is how Texas, and this goes back to what I was talking about earlier with how a team utilizes their bullpen. Texas, if anybody's not aware, they don't have a top reliever on contract for 2024. Jose Leclerc is the only one, and he has a team option. So it's likely that he is brought back. But Will Smith's a free agent. I think Jonathan Hernandez is also a free agent as well. So Leclerc is pretty much the obvious in-house closer that they have if they don't go out and get somebody else on free agency like we talked about with Baltimore's possibilities. But how they utilize Leclerc in this, the rest of the remaining part of this postseason, as far as deep as they get. And if he is the consistent go-to, and I know that there was a lot of back and forth over the course of, obviously, with Chapman and Will Smith, and then Leclerc was getting in on the action as well toward the end of the season as well. Again, we are in the biggest stage here. How they, if they put the trust in him now and he performs, it makes me more likely to jump in on him on early drafts with the assumption that the Rangers trust him enough not to go out and get a Josh Hader or a Craig Kimball or somebody else with the experience to take that role.
Yep, I agree. Another Ranger as well that's probably going to be fairly popular as we get into early drafts, but a big postseason could send him skyrocketing is Evan Carter. Yeah, we're already after two postseason games. I was seeing comps on Twitter to Kyle Tucker. If that's not going to send your draft costs soaring, I don't know what will.
I think the only thing that'll up that is if all of a sudden they find a way to get Wyatt Langford into the postseason roster. Yeah, and he just skips everything. And then, yeah, we're already expecting him to be on the opening day roster. That would be something if they found a way to circumvent that and made him eligible for that. All right, Kevin, anybody else that obviously stands out that we haven't talked about? There's still obviously a lot of players and a lot of things that can happen, but I think those are some pretty good names that they have the ability of really impacting how people are looking at them, especially in drafts. Like nothing's going to happen with the guys at the top. Like Kyle Tucker can't do anything to change his ADP besides something really, never mind. I'm going to edit that part out.
Don't say it.
But like these guys aren't going to do anything for anybody who's already going in the first two rounds is not of concern. We're talking about, this is why I brought up Jeremy Peña, who's going at in the 130, you go 130 to 106. Not guys that are going from two, which isn't going to happen anyway. Anybody else that worth mentioning?
Some of the young Dodgers pitchers, I think the Dodgers don't seem to have the depth at pitching we're used to them having, almost limping into the postseason as far as pitching goes. If guys like Bobby Miller go out and dominate, that's just going to, they're already going to be popular anyway, but that would definitely boost their value in the early draft season. It would go up dramatically, I think, if those guys perform. Younger players in general, right? I think some of the guys that, even if we've seen them all season long, even if they were with the team at the beginning of April of last year, it still just verifies what we saw throughout the season. And if they came up later and on throughout the season, and maybe even if they struggled at points during the season, if they perform in the postseason, we get it in our heads. Oh, if they can do it in the playoffs, then they can do it against anybody. So young players in general as well.
Yeah, I think Ryan Pepiot has the opportunity to be this year's Christian Javier.
100%.
Like maybe not with the same exact strikeout rate that Javier brought to the table, but he's already got some hype based on what he was able to do toward the end of the season with the Dodgers. And if he's able to build on that, even if it is from a bullpen perspective, which it most likely will be the majority of the time, he might get a start. But I think
those are higher leverage situations. They get even more focus.
And he could easily go two innings, two and a half, two mm-hmm. and a third, maybe even three innings in certain situations. Just not if he was pitching for the Blue Jays, that is, of course. So
Joe Arrico is going to hate listening to this episode because he was so fired up on Twitter yesterday and we keep alluding to it. Sorry, Joe. Can't wait to
not
see
alluding,
you.
Not alluding. We're just calling it out.
I can't wait to see it here in less than 4 weeks now. But yeah, sorry about your Blue Jays, man.
Yeah. And Joe can make it up by kicking all our butts in the draft in our first listener league draft. He is signed up.
Yes, he is.
If you are not signed up, make sure you are DMing me, DM on the wire pod. Ask us if by the time this comes out, there's still an opening. Hopefully there is not, but we will be doing more drafts throughout the season. I would say, Kevin, at least one a month. That's pretty much what we did in the first half of the offseason last year. Mm-hmm. We did one a month, and then we upped it to two a month as we got closer and closer to March. So yeah, we'll mix and match a couple 15s, a couple 12s. So if you like those 12s, you can wait for one of those. We'll do another, at least one more 15, I think, just so we can combine the leagues and have an overall prize of a Yoohoo shower, but it's still overall. And I would be remiss not to bring up the fact that we do have final standings for the 2023. Tweeted that out.
We had a change.
Yes, that was a surprise. And actually, Kevin, I don't know, but I don't want to speak for you, but I didn't notice until we got the text. So
it's hit me looking at every league I'm in, right?
First and foremost, we invited KC Bubba onto the show because he was leading by a decent amount, KC. And then he fell down. I think, I don't understand in front of me, but I think he ended up being fourth overall. And then listener Adam Lazarus, hopefully, Adam, I'm saying your name correctly, your last name correctly, but Adam Lazarus, not on Twitter, can't tag him, or at least he didn't want to give me his Twitter handle, which I do not blame you if that's the case. Congratulations. He held on to that first spot. Oh, wait a minute. One last possible second. They made all the stats from the Thursday Miami Mets game official.
Only 8 innings.
That's it.
The top of the ninth didn't count. Yeah.
Only 8. And yeah, so all those, any of the stats that might have happened in the top of the ninth, Miami scoring those two runs, those go out the window. But their stats go final. And lo and behold, we have a co-overall champion. The one and only Yancey Ian jumps up into a share of first place with Adam Lazarus. So congratulations to both Yancey and Adam. Hopefully we can get you guys back on, or Yancey back on the pod, and Adam, if interested, we'd love to have you on the pod as well in the near future this offseason to talk about that and then your plans for 2024 as well. So congratulations to all you guys. Thank you everybody who participated. We had 10 leagues of 12, 120. Obviously, there were a couple double entries in there, so we didn't have 120 individuals, but we had 120 teams. I would hope and expect that we will get just as many, if not more, for the 2024 Listener League between the two sets of leagues that we end up doing. So if you're interested, shoot us a DM. We'll get you on the pre-registration wait list, and we'll definitely get you in. And we're going to keep all of our leagues at $50, very approachable. Really good prize pool. Kevin, you talked about that on the last show or the previous show. Because these are satellite leagues, we do an overall, but it's just for fun. So all the prize money goes right back into the league winners, and NFBC takes their cut, but it's a much smaller cut than when you play in an overall contest. So that's nice.
Yeah, and when you're DMing myself or Adam or at On the Wired Pod, let us know when you'd like to draft so we can start planning how many drafts per month that we're going to try to roll out.
Yeah, and how many you want to do, let us know that too, because we had lots of people. I think we had at least one or two people do every single one. Shout out David Odom, I think you were in every single draft. Congratulations on your success in that as well. He's in this early draft as well. Yep. Glad to have you, man, and we'll have a good time once it's full and drafted. Got some fun people in it. Hopefully it's full, hopefully all this doesn't matter, but
yep, we'll get the next one exactly rolling soon.
Cool. Gavin, anything else you want to add before we head on out of here?
No, just another reminder. We've talked about it the last couple of weeks. Scrape your data if it's something you want to be looking at through the offseason, especially when we're talking these early drafts. It can become a little difficult to get some of the information you may be looking for. And enjoy the postseason. Have a good time. We love baseball first, right?
Yeah, baseball first. Baseball for all. All right, guys, that is going to wrap it up for episode 135 of On the Wire. You can follow myself on the Twitter at 80 grade. That's all spelled out. Kevin is at Hasting Kevin. Of course, follow the pod itself at On the Wire Pod. After all that, I am Adam Howe on behalf of Kevin Hasting. Thanks for listening, and we bid you goodbye.